The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 209, Puppies and Rainbows edition, for Monday, June 29th, 2009. How'd you like that?
Greetings. Hi, John. How are you?
You're not going to let me do the intro again. So let me explain
that's
that.
That's the end of it.
So one of our favorite listeners, Scott Barman, also DC Dog, said that we had too many rants in the last podcast. So I promise, and he told us that we could only say nice things in this podcast. So I promised we would do the Puppies and Rainbows edition for him. Of course, you know, if everything was perfect, then we have nothing to rant or complain about. So I don't know if you want a podcast where all we do is say nice things about, you know, software and hardware and stuff like that.
Preach on, man. That's John Braun there, live from Fairfield, Connecticut. I'm Dave Hamilton here in the TMO Towers East in Durham, New Hampshire. We are the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. That was funny, John. You know, we got a lot of questions in over the last week, and I tried to be creative about how we put them together. Normally we organize by topic, and trying to be thematic about it. And tonight the theme for organizing the questions, what I tried to do was short questions that would be short answers. And then the long things where we sort of go into, a little more depth. So we're going to try that. We'll see if my guesses were correct, because you never really know when we start to answer a question, what's going to happen.
That's why, yeah, I think it's a tough call.
I'm sure it's a failed experiment before we even start. So let's defer the start of the experiment off a little bit. I finally had the opportunity to get up and running on this Runcore SSD drive. Now, the way it works is it's actually pretty cool. They send you a drive and an enclosure, a USB, it's a SATA drive, right? It's a 2.5 inch. The one they sent me was the 128 gig Pro 4 SATA. So it's a 128 gig SSD drive. The list price on the thing is $500, $499. So bear all that in mind, right? And we can talk about price in a little bit here, John, and how it relates to the rest of the world. But it comes with a case, and in theory, the drive comes with a copy of Super Duper on it, I think is what it's supposed to have on it. It didn't, at least I tried, I put the drive in the case. The idea is you put the drive in the case, you hook it up to your computer, you run Super Duper to clone everything from your internal hard drive over to this. Then you crack open your computer, you replace the internal hard drive, you put the SSD drive in, and then you're good to go.
Okay, so this is specifically a Mac version.
Exactly.
I guess, and external is the intent, I guess. Though,
No, internal is the end result, but they know that you need to hook it up externally to your laptop to get there, so they include this case in the price and bundle of the drive. Okay.
So you did put it, okay. So you were using it internally or externally?
Well, I'll explain. So I put it in the external case, I hooked it up USB 2, right? And then... I realized it was a Windows formatted disk, and there was no Super Duper on here anywhere I looked, but it didn't matter. I had Super Duper. So I reformatted it as a, a HFS plus volume with all the right permissions and all that stuff. I set it up as a GUID disk, repartitioned the whole thing. And then I ran my own copy of Super Duper, which I use every day anyway, and copied all the data over. And it took a while, right? I mean, I copied a little over 100 gigs of data. So, I just let it run all night. And then I booted back up. Now, I have a 15-inch MacBook Pro that I bought last February. So it is the old model, which means 20 screws and lots of sweat and 10 more gray hairs in order to get the hard drive out and replaced. So and the other thing is I'm still in the market for, I think I'm going to buy one of those 13-inch MacBook Pros. But I'm going to wait until they hit the refurb store. So I might be a month or two. So I figured, if I'm going to do that, even if it's in a month or two, I can live off of a USB drive for a little bit here.
So I would say, though, with this particular model of machine, Dave,
yep.
I may even choose to have someone else do it.
It's not that
this
bad.
Is not for the, well, I would say this is not for a beginner.
Definitely not.
If you know how to use a screwdriver and you know how to use a soldering iron and
you're not afraid to get dirty, because there's things that you've got to, like, you know, peel little connectors off, and you've got to have a pretty decent amount of manual dexterity and trust in yourself. Right.
Yeah. And if you know how to, you know, ground yourself and know why you should, especially when you're poking around inside your machine, then yeah, go for it. Yep. But you may want to
go ahead.
And we covered this before, like, you know, get a little, like, an ice cube tray or something like that. You want to keep track of all the screws. Maybe take pictures along the way, just because I don't, again, from what I recall when I did this with our pal Duffy,
it gets ugly.
So you got to be very precise and be able to follow instructions exactly. So anyways, did they include instructions to do that? They did, to a degree.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll state up front that the SATA interface inside the computer, if I were to mount this drive internally, would allow this drive to go faster than over USB. And there's some benchmarks of these drives that say they will actually pretty easily, as far as data transfer rates, beat USB when they're installed internally via SATA. So I am admitting up front that I am not necessarily getting full performance out of this drive. And I'm okay with that because of all the aforementioned conditions. So I get the thing up and I reboot the computer. And then immediately upon rebooting, what I do is I unmounted my internal hard drive so that it wasn't even appearing on the desktop, so nobody could find it. And then before I did that, I added it to the Time Machine exclusion list and all of that. So, you know, I got it to the point where I'm happy running off of this USB drive. It is. So there's something very instantly very different about running off of a SATA drive. A couple of things. One is it's silent. Right. I mean, it makes no noise. You don't have any of that grinding or crunching or head spinning or platter spinning and heads moving and all that stuff that happens inside a hard drive. It's just quiet. It just runs. But the big difference to me is I don't know if 0 millisecond is the right measurement, but very, very close to 0 millisecond seek time. And what I mean by that is, When you have a physical hard drive that has platters and heads in it, you know, I think of it like an old record player, which I realize as I explain it every time is probably lost on more and more of the audience out there, because nobody uses record players anymore. But I'll stick with the analogy. And the idea is, you know, you've got this platter or record spinning inside in the drive, and then you've got the heads or the needles that kind of dance around on it searching for data. And the time that it takes the drive to jump the needle from one spot to another is called seek time. And they, you know, they'll publish specs for average seek time. And, you know, I don't know whether they're down to 10 milliseconds or 9 milliseconds sometimes now, but that's an average. And that's, you know, usually a better case average than not. A lot of times, if you've got to jump all over the place, especially if you're jumping, right, you know, from the furthest point to the furthest point and back multiple times, it's going to be a whole lot more than 9 milliseconds. And right, we've all seen this, right? You know, have you ever tried to launch 4 apps at once? Or, you know, if Time Machine is running and Mobile Me is syncing and you're trying to type or launch a web page in Safari where it's got to, you know, read or write from the cache, a lot of disk activity can just bind up your system and really, really slow you down.
Oh, with yeah, this, I'll see menu meters on constantly.
Right.
And that's, I think, how you tell that, you know, your drives are real busy. It may be reading and writing at the same time, in which case, yeah, you're
hosed. Right. Yeah. And you'll see the CPU sit very low during those times, usually, while the drives are, it's just basically waiting on data and it can't really do anything until it gets that data. And heaven forbid, during one of those operations, it has to create a swap file and page, you know, stuff from RAM out to it, right? I mean, all this stuff, you just hear the computer grind down, right? And that simply doesn't happen with this SSD drive because there's no moving parts. It literally doesn't have any motor or anything inside it. It's just a chip.
So I think you're dealing with a memory controller, I guess.
Exactly.
You're saying, okay, read from here. And obviously, to me, the time to do that in memory versus a physical device is way, way, way less.
It's way less. So even
just way less, not way, way, way.
It's even though I'm running over USB and maybe not getting full throughput out of the drive, I'm certainly getting the benefit of no or very, very little seek time. And let me tell you, one day on this thing, and I knew that this was by far the most, the biggest upgrade in terms of performance impact that I've ever done to a computer ever. And that includes, you know, doubling the RAM or, you know, processor speed, even processor speed, because, you know, you're always waiting on the stupid disk. It's always in the way. And it's even more so now that we've all got, relatively speaking, you know, wicked fast processors and gobs of RAM. I mean, compared to, you know, you and I, we started with 64K of RAM and 1 megahertz processor, right? You know, but we were, even back then, what are you doing most of the time? Well, waiting on the disk. Why? Because the disk is the slowest link in the chain. So it makes a huge difference. I can launch 4 apps and, you know, then open or then click on Safari and just start doing my thing. And the apps launch in the background and it's fine. But there is no wait. There's nothing. It just cooks. It's awesome. And it's, you know, after I run it for a couple of days, I picked up the drive, which is just in a metal, you know, the metal case that they gave me and with it. And it, I mean, it's cool to the touch. There's no heat. It's absolutely fantastic. It really is the single most, the single biggest performance update I've ever seen from an upgrade, you know, from an incremental upgrade that you can do to your computer.
Really?
Yeah.
Like going from a floppy to a hard drive?
Yeah, that's right. It's akin to that. That's right. Yeah.
I'm thinking hard drive technology is, I mean, other than them getting bigger and bigger and maybe bigger caches and buses,
mm-hmm.
I mean, those are kind of incremental. This is a new animal, which I think they're still refining.
Yeah, it's an order of magnitude difference. I mean, it is instant. You notice it and especially notice it over time. I mean, I don't even realize that I have, you know, exceeded the amount of RAM that I have and paged out to disk or anything. It's not an issue until I fill up the, you know, the flash drive, but or the SSD drive. Right. But, you know, up until I fill it up, it's just not an issue. It really impressive. I'm totally blown away by this thing. So, you know, the question is, what do I do? You know, do I, my question, and I haven't looked, and I haven't actually don't have an Apple SSD drive to test and see how theirs compare to the Runcore and all that. But that would be the next interesting experiment to do. But very impressed with the Runcore, other than the fact that it didn't have Super Duper on the drive when I put it in. But for me, that wasn't an issue. Hopefully, you know, for the rest of the world, they've got that sorted okay. out. So
Runcore makes the drive.
Presumably, it's their name on the drive, and I, from what I understand, they are making these themselves. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just curious if do you have it on a machine now?
It's on my MacBook Pro downstairs. Yeah, and you're gonna have
just
to pry it out of my
info. Yeah, I understand.
Pry it out of my cold dead fingers if you ever, you know, if anybody ever wants this thing. You know, it's a review loaner, so I'm sure I'm gonna have to pay them for it. It's gonna be much easier to get the money out of my hands than it is the drive. Mm-hmm. Let's just put it that way. So.
Cool. So, I'd be curious what you see when you go to, if you go into hardware, USB, if it identifies the brand of driver, if it says Runcore, which it probably does.
You know, the computer fell asleep.
Not important. Let us know next time.
Yeah, I'll report it next time.
Now, yeah, so this is up and coming because, I don't have a report. We'll save that for next time.
Okay.
But I was at a show in New York City last week, and there were... It was called Rock and Bowl. So Pepcom puts these on. It's media events. They have, you know, 40, 50 vendors, usually some interesting theme. This was a bowling night, of course. So they had a bowling fair, like, you know, hot dogs and...
Oh, nice.
A lot of stuff that wasn't good for you. So...
of course.
Oh, man, you know, tater tots and, you know, and fish and chili and, you know, stuff that you'd find in, like, a bowling hall.
Sure, that's awesome.
Bird bowling alley. So anyways, they had not one, Dave, not two, but three vendors there also showing SSD drives. I believe it was Seagate, Western Digital, and Kingston.
Okay. Okay. So them. Yeah, so there's people are hot on this trail. Yeah.
Yeah. And this sounds like state of the art, because I think the largest size right now, last I checked, was 128 gigabytes. That's about the largest you're going to get.
Okay.
Unless so, someone's...
No, they've Runcore sells, and I believe it's $899, but they sell a 256 gig drive. Now, we should talk about the technology that's used inside SSD drives. They used to be, I mean, let's face it, they're still expensive. I mean, $500 for 128 gigs, right? You can probably get that for somewhere between 50 and 80 in a regular, you know, 2.5-inch laptop size hard drive. So you're definitely paying a premium, but even though it's almost an order of magnitude premium, it's only a couple $100, right? It's $400, but still, it's not, you know, $4,000. It's not totally astronomical. And I'll be frank, if you're somebody that travels a lot with a laptop, you know, the benefits go beyond everything I've already mentioned, the speed and all that. Mm-hmm. You now have a drive that is solid state. And I know that's in the name, but it's worth considering that a solid state drive, if you drop your MacBook, is not really going to suffer from any, motion problems that a hard drive would. Now, yeah, Apple has the sudden motion sensor, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure that's good. But let's face it, right? You know, I mean, if the drive doesn't have moving parts, even better. So,
right. So I see one downside.
Okay.
We can move on. So one downside of these drives, a lot of times when, when I'm wondering if my machine is actually on or running, I'll sometimes bend over and put my ear near the keyboard and listen to see if I hear the hard drive spinning or chattering. You're not going to have that with these.
No, you're not.
Maybe that's probably a good thing.
I was going to say, I'm not so sure that I would be all that concerned about it. Let's put it this way. Until you mentioned it, I hadn't really worried about that particular aspect of this drive as a negative.
I figure not.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is that these, I would imagine, at least from a power standpoint, is going to be drawing relatively less power. I don't know if you have any numbers in front of you, but
I don't have those numbers, but I would definitely assume that. Yeah. I mean, it stands to reason, right?
So versus running a motor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, cool. Okay. So I'll have some more details for the next show about some others, but that's awesome. So
it's worth talking about the technology, because as we get into this, people will see two different types of SSD drives mentioned. There are SLC, single layer controller, I think, and MLC, multi-layer controller. I will preface this by saying I do not know enough about this technology to try and translate it into human, as I often try to do for everyone here. But what I do know is in single layer cells and multi-layer cells, in single layer cells, a single bit is stored in each cell. In a multi-layer cell, multiple bits are stored in the same cell. For reasons that I don't fully understand, and maybe you do, John, but if you don't, we'll leave it at that. Reading and writing from single layer cells is much, much faster than reading and writing from multi-layer cells. But it's cheaper to make multi-layer cell drives. What the folks at Runcore have been able to do is get massive bandwidth out of multi-layer cells. And the benefit there, of course, is that they can sell these at, using air quotes, cheaper prices, because it is about half the price of a single layer cell. And as far as the benchmarks go, and like I said, I can't really test it yet because I don't have it internal to the machine. So USB isn't really the right interface for this. But Runcore is getting, gobs and gobs of bandwidth out of these things compared to the reports from other folks. Now, I'm sure, they're not the only ones. As you mentioned, Western Digital, Kingston and Seagate probably hot on the trail here and maybe, even surpassing it. So.
OK, yeah, I see a section on this. I did not. Well, now it makes sense, actually, because at least one of the vendors had a S series and an M series.
Right.
I bet you that's exactly what they're doing. They're offering different drives for different reasons. Let me read up on this. I have a section here, but I'm not going to read it now.
Right.
And maybe I can go into a little more depth next week when I talk about the different ones that I saw and a few other toys.
Yep. Cool. Okay. So that's like I said, the only decision I have to make when I get the new MacBook Pro is to get the Apple SSD drive in it, which is a $350 delta to put the 128 gig Apple SSD in versus the Runcore one, which is, $500 upgrade. But of course, I get another hard drive out of it. So,
and actually, I'm curious from our listeners, if you do have an Apple machine with an SSD, if you could take a peek in System Profiler and see which one they're using. I'm curious because Apple doesn't make their own drives. They may sometimes, you know, have them specially made, and they'll have a little Apple on the sticker and stuff like that. But I'd be curious who their vendor or vendors of choice is. It may be whoever is convenient at the time.
Just for the record, John, I did look in System Profile. I woke up the machine downstairs and checked it. Because it's USB, all I get to see is the brand name of the controller. I don't get to see the brand name of the drive. So it's not a fair comparison. But for those interested, Runcore is using controllers in this drive anyway, in this USB case from Initio, Initio, but that's probably inconsequential to this conversation. So, all right. So it's time to get to the shorts. But before we do that, our first sponsor for the night, Audio Engine. The beauty of talking about Audio Engine is they have so many different cool products that that we can tell you about at AudioEngineUSA.com. But the one that I constantly and repeatedly hear from listeners about is the Audio Engine A5s, which is really their flagship product. It's the first product they ever came out with. These are what they call bookshelf speakers. You can put them on your desk, but they're big. You know, they're probably, you have a set, John, that, you know, maybe almost a foot tall and, you know, 6 inches wide and maybe 8 inches deep. Two speakers, two separate enclosures, and then two speakers inside each enclosure, a woofer and a tweeter. And the sound that you get out of these things is huge. You know, you can actually buy a subwoofer, the S8, to go along with it. But in many instances, you probably won't even need it. I mean, they just have a full, warm sound, and they really kick. Now, they're $349 for the pair if you're going to get black or white. If you want a wood grain, add $100 to it because it's actually a wood grained enclosure. It's not, you know, simulated wood grain. It's real wood. The beauty is they will allow you a free audition, they call it. You buy them, they'll ship them to you, which is free shipping, and you get 30 days to audition these at your home or office or wherever you're going to set them up, and you're good to go. The A5s have a couple of interesting features in addition to obviously being self-powered speakers. They have an AC outlet on the back, so you could hang an Airport Express off of these, and then they've got different inputs that you can use. You can use RCA jack inputs or the little Mini 8 headphone style input. It's also got a USB port on the top that you can use to charge your iPod if that's connected or your iPhone or whatever you want. You just plug your little USB dock connector in and up you go. So it's the Audio Engine A5 premium bookshelf speakers for $349 from AudioEngineUSA.com. And now,
dude, I got to say they rock. I got the A5s. I don't know how they do this, but to me, one test of speakers is if you can turn them all the way up and they don't distort.
Right.
These do not. They just get louder, much to the enjoyment of anybody in the surrounding area.
There you go. All right. Rob writes, quick question. Regarding wireless networking, I understand that if an N network is being shared with agents connecting with B, G, and N adapters, the network speed will be degraded to an extent because of the presence of B and G agents connecting on the network. Does this fact apply only when those B and G adapters are actively moving data, or does it apply even when those adapters are inactive? I have an Apple Airport Extreme base station, which automatically switches between. Oh, we don't have to talk about the rest of it. Okay, so there's the question. Does the fact apply when B and G adapters are actively moving data, or does it even apply when adapters are inactive? Hi, John.
That's a great question. I would say if the base sees another a compatibility, a machine that is taking advantage of compatibility mode, just the fact that it's there, I would say, would put it in and I think that's what it's called, compatibility mode. I know we found documentation on this which that talks about that or something similar. So I think just the fact that other people that are not the high speed network are on there is going to put you in this mode where you're not going to get the best performance. I think the way to get the best performance, at least with Airport, for example, is when you configure the radio, can configure it for an only option and not a compatible option, because the compatible implies that you're going to be letting people, you're going to be mixing different flavors of 802.11.
Right. And just to be fair, it if you set your radio to be fully compatible, but you only have N clients connected, it will operate at N only speeds. But as soon as a G or B client is connected, it's not going to slow the N people all the way down to B or G. But it is going to, I think what we found, John, was that it reduces the packet size, and that then kind of reduces the throughput, even though you're connecting it at a faster speed. I think that was it in a nutshell, if I'm not mistaken, right, John?
That sounds about right, but okay. If we're wrong, somebody will tell us.
It's great. So it's as soon as that client is alive, meaning it's connected, associated with the base station and powered on, like, i.e. not asleep, whether or not it's passing data back and forth, I don't think that matters. I think you're going to see the performance hit as soon as that client is attached. So,
yeah. Now, I got one piece of advice for Rob, because in his email.
Yep.
So he was talking about different flavors. Bleh. There we go. Of 802.n. So of course, 802.11. So of course there's N, which is however many megabits per second.
270.
G, which is 54. And B, which I think is 11.
11.
Dude, get that B out of there, man.
Yeah.
That's just going to drag you way down, I think. That's like the worst possible scenarios to have all of those. If anything, I would suggest get a El Cheapo, if they even still make them. Get a B and isolate that baby.
Yeah, it, that's actually true. Get you know, for $50 or less, you could get a base station that'll do B, even if it'll do B and G. You know, isolate that out so that your N devices are clean, pristine, and running mean.
Because I'm just running N and G. I got to run G because that's on the TiVo. So
There's no why. So we are clearly incapable of answering short questions. I mean, we've proven that already. that's okay though. So here's the advice for the TiVo, because I've talked about this with my brother, because you know TiVo does not sell nor support 802.11n adapters for TiVo, but the Series 3 TiVo has a processor that will let it go fast enough to where it will actually transfer data at speeds faster than 802.11g. Yeah, but here's it, and you could connect Ethernet to it and go, you know, at least 100 megabit, if not gigabit. I think it's got a gigabit port in it. So here's the idea. You can fake it with an N connection by buying an N capable router and setting it up in WDS mode. Right. So let the router attach to your other N router that's actually sending the signal. Right. And then plug an Ethernet cable from the router into the TiVo and it'll go faster. So there's your geeky advice
now,
of the day.
Now, this plugs in via USB. I mean, although they encourage you, and I think I guess my question is there someone that makes a USB N adapter?
Yes, but TiVo doesn't support it.
Does that mean that
it will not work?
It will not. Okay.
Yep.
I'm just wondering if there's an unsupport, like, you know, some may. Okay.
Yep.
So is it that it only works with theirs at this point?
No, there are others that it will work with, but none of them are the N capable adapters.
Okay. Cause typically a USB device has a vendor and a product code. So I think if it just sees one that it doesn't recognize on the cool kids list, it's just not going to,
well, it's got to have a driver in there. So, all right. So should we try the next one to be a quick question, John? It won't be, I already know it won't be, but that's okay.
This will be quick.
Hi. In your last podcast, technically you misused the terms differential and incremental with regards to backups. Technically, a differential backup copies all the files that have changed since the last full backup without marking them as having been backed up, whereas an incremental backup backs up all the files that are marked as needing to be backed up and then marks them as being backed up, difference being if you have two or three incremental updates, backups since your last full backup, and something goes haywire, then you got to do restore the full backup, and then the three incremental backups in sequence to get back. Whereas if you have a differential, you can skip those first two differential backups and go straight to the third differential backup. So then you have two restore operations, the full and then the one differential. Anyway, just wanted to clear that up. Thanks. Bye.
I love this guy, John, because we get, you know, we've played comments from him before, but he just launches right in. He doesn't say hi. He doesn't identify himself. He just launches right in to the question or the comment. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a comment correcting something that he sees that we got wrong, and off we go. All right. Josh writes, I have an iMac fully updated with an external hard drive attached. I use the external hard drive only for multimedia storage, music, videos, pictures, etc. So the only time it should be accessed is via iTunes, QuickTime or iPhoto, or if browsing it. For some reason, Safari seems to be accessing the drive. Occasionally while browsing the internet, with the aforementioned applications all closed, my browser will freeze beach ball and the external drive will spin up. This only lasts for about 15 seconds and is more of an annoyance than a problem, but I was wondering if you knew any way to see what was reading or writing to or from the external drive. Other things I've checked, Time Machine ignores the external drive, downloads from Safari go to my internal drive, and I have no apps at all installed on the external. All right, John, any thoughts there?
Wow. You know, we talked about this a few weeks ago, I think, but there is a utility, LSOF.
Mm-hmm.
Which you could run that and then using various magic see what, if anything, Safari has open that it really shouldn't.
Actually, what you would do is search not for Safari, but search for the path. Well, you could search for Safari, but that's under the assumption that it's Safari that's causing this, but it may very well be something else. So what I would do is in the LSOF output, I would look for the path to the drive.
Yes.
Right. And then that's going to tell you what's accessing it. But I have a similar setup. I've got a couple external drives that I don't use a whole lot, especially now that I've got the Time Capsule for backups and the Drobo for archiving. And occasionally, you know, I'll have to sit through that, you know, 10-second beach ball while it spins up or one of them spins up. And I even hear it with the Drobo. The Drobo will sometimes spin up and, you know, that's got to then spin up three drives because that's what it has in it. So you wait even longer. And I see this sometimes for no rhyme or reason. You know, the OS has a lot going on in the background. So I never really thought about it before as an issue. But LSOF would presumably answer that question if you can catch it at the right time.
Yeah, a couple other thoughts. So, yep. You can try this, Energy Saver, System Preferences, Energy Saver, Sleep. Put hard disks to sleep if possible. There's a checkbox.
Right.
Give it a whirl. Though in this case, it doesn't sound like that'll fix the problem, but in other cases, it may.
Well,
it's correlated to Safari.
If you uncheck the box, it would, in theory, stop the delay from happening. Though we've heard some external drives spin down on their own. You know, the internal electronics to the drive say that, well, no data is passed back and forth. I'm going to go ahead and spin the drive down regardless of what the computer tells it to do. So.
Yeah. And the one thing I could think is that I run something and I don't know if this is at a low level in the OS or what, but, you know, there is something called Smart, which is a technology that monitors a drive's health. And if something is starting to go or gone, assuming it can still see the drive, the Smart mechanism will... tell you what's going on. I have something that I run on both my machines called Smart Reporter. It basically makes occasional check of the drive saying, hey, what's your smart status? And it's like, everything's great. And it's that's. And you can get that through one of the Apple. The Disutility actually also shows the smart status. So I'm wondering if that's happening at a low
level. I think I know the answer.
Really?
Yeah. I did a little search for Safari spins up external drive here. And I found an Apple discussion where somebody did exactly what we're talking about and posted the output from essentially LSOF. We'll say that. I think they got it a different way. But what they're finding is that ATS server, which is the Apple Type Services server or the thing that manages fonts in Safari, goes ahead and spins up other drives when it's looking for deactivated fonts.
Dude.
So... That could very well be it. If you look, you know, a web page that you're visiting in Safari is calling for a font that you don't have. And so it's spinning up and just making sure it doesn't exist elsewhere.
So it sounds kind of dumb.
Yeah, you know what? I agree.
Well, you think it'd be like, hey, you know, there's probably not fonts. Like, you would think a font cache or something like that would indicate the state of fonts in the machine. You wouldn't have to do this sort of thing. Anyways.
Yeah, a cache would be a great idea. I mean, that would just be, that would be awesome. But maybe they'll fix it in Snow Leopard. Who knows? They're putting a lot of work into that.
So. Yeah, and I've also heard like WD drives will actually do the opposite sometimes. I've known people that have Western Digital drives, and I think some of them, it's baked in the firmware. They will not spin down. There's just something weird. Even if you tell them, yo, dude, go to sleep, they'll be like, nope.
Really?
Yeah, I know we had someone write in with certain models and the Mac. They may have since fixed that through a driver or firmware or something like that. But I have heard of that problem where... You would expect the drive to do what you tell it, but some just don't. So I'll dig that up too for the ever popular show notes. I know it was a tech note that I had somewhere.
Okay.
Huh. Right.
All right. So now moving on to Brian. And Brian writes, I have a Western, speaking of West hard drives and Western Digital drives, I have a Western Digital 500 gigabyte external hard drive. The power supply recently died on me, and according to a Google search of the product, I am hardly the only one with this issue. I purchased the product about a year and a half ago, so I know the product is out of warranty. While attempting to purchase another power supply, it is seemingly difficult to come up with the exact model power supply. I have, however, found many similar to it, same number of pins, on eBay and Amazon, but I'm unsure if one of these other power supplies would work for this product. Okay, so there's a couple of things. Let's answer... This isn't a short answer either.
No. Well, the most immediate answer,
yes,
I could offer.
Yep.
All right. Western Digital, right?
Yep.
And first off, a finger wag at them. Not a rant, a finger wag, because I was trying to go to their page to look this up, but I also have it in my notes.
Okay.
Dude, you don't play sounds on a web page unless people give you permission, all right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So that... No, that's not a finger wag. That's a fist shake. Stop that, man. I mean, what if...
I hate
that's
that.
That's just lame. Give me a button that says... Unmute, okay, that I can deal with, but don't assault me like that.
Right.
So anyways, the easy answer here is that, so I looked up that product model. I eventually found what it was, and it is a version of a Curtin product. If you go to their site, you go to home, accessories, power supplies, voila, they have power supplies for pretty much, because this drive is, from what I recall, a USB drive, but it also has a, as we fondly call it, a wall wart.
Yep, okay.
So it sounds like it can't always operate off a USB power, so sometimes you may need external power for this drive.
Sure.
And it sounds like it died, and it looked like, you know, some of the supplies were, you know, $10 to $15. You could do that. It may just be a cheap El Cheapo power supply, and they just kind of die. You could go, if it's a standard, what I'll call a barrel connector, and you can figure out the voltage and the current. Radio Shack has some nice semi-universal things, I think, still, where they have multiple tips. They can do multiple voltages. Just keep an eye on the current. It may not have enough to power everything.
Right.
So, quick and dirty, but then this gets into an area, Dave, where I disregarded your suggestion as just...
Right.
Kind of throwing in the towel, but go on.
Yeah. So, you know, I saw this and thought, okay, well, I'm sure we can find a power supply. You know, Western Digital might take an hour on the phone with, you know, support, but somebody there knows the answer of what kind of, you know, power supply this needs. But if you're seeing that other people are having similar problems, it is worth at least bearing in mind through this, this ordeal that the hard drive itself is not married to the case. Now, they're both likely Western Digital drives. It'd be very funny if Western Digital had the case and then had somebody else's drive inside it. But, you know, you can take that Western Digital drive out of that case and put it into any aftermarket case that you know, will support that type and size of drive. And there's lots of them out there. Now, they're not cheap. They're usually about $100. So, depending on the price and difficulty involved in getting the power supply, you might be better off that way. But you know, I just wanted to bear that in mind. And that works the other way, too. If the hard drive itself dies, don't throw away the case. You know, you might want to pitch the drive, but save the case because you might run into a situation like this. And so, you know, there you go. There is a lot of chatter happening in our little Skype room here.
Well, I'm going to tell you per your suggestion. So Pete chimed in here, and I agree with him. So actually, the person that wrote in, I'm hiding that. What am I doing here? Brian, I'm sorry. He mentioned multiple pins. All right. As it turns out, this is some sort of annoying proprietary connector, because Pete indicates it looks like an S-video connector. So it sounds like it may have four pins or something like that, maybe multiple voltages and stuff. So I think that's proprietary enough where you may have to only get it from them. Though I don't know if Radio Shack has expanded their, you know, wall wart product line. Which, did you hear this thing about some initiative over in Europe, like for a standard for cell phone chargers or something?
I did. Yeah, Apple. We ran an article at TMO today on that.
That's where I saw it.
Yep, Apple and other companies have agreed to adhere to this very standard cell phone charger standard, I guess, where there's one connector that works. Now, you and I both know that what they're going to do is they're going to make a thing that plugs into that connector and then connects to the dock connector on the bottom, because they're not going to abandon the dock connector on the iPhone or any other iPod right now. But so all good stuff.
All right. I think,
we can talk about Mark's tip here. I think this was good. You know, we were talking about the new MacBook Pros, right? And how they have the SD card slot and how great that is compared to the Express card slot. Well, Mark writes in, I would have to agree with you that for the most part, the Express card slot in the MacBook Pro is pretty much wasted, and the SD reader was a good trade. But I did find a use for the Express card slot in my late 2008 MacBook Pro unibody today. And what is it? It's a Kensington Express card media reader, which, of course, provides you with an SD card slot in your Express card. Now, he says that fits flush right up against the side of the MacBook Pro, so it essentially turns it into what you already have. And I think we found them at Kensington, and it was only about $30, maybe $40. Definitely worth checking out if you want that functionality in your existing MacBook Pro and don't want to have to trade out to do it.
And I think the big plus is that Express card, because I have which I've had for a number of years, a USB kind of universal, you know, tiny memory card reader.
Yep.
That'll read CF and SD and then, you know, a few different ones. But the thing is, that's only USB 2. Express card is, I believe, an order of magnitude faster. You're talking hundreds of megabytes per second, I think, in general, for an Express card 34, which I think is what they used to have.
Yep.
On the Mac, I'm just looking very quickly here, but I see a lot of references to 200 or so megabytes per second. So you're going to be, you know, moving data around very quickly versus a USB device.
Right. Good
point. It's such a waste for an Express card slot. It just has so much potential, you know, to make it just an SD reader.
Yeah, what are you going to do with it? I mean, what are you doing with yours?
All sorts of things.
Oh, yeah. Is that right?
I like pushing the little door in every now and then and out. And
store paper clips in there?
No.
Okay.
No, actually, someone that I work with, because I saw one of the machines at work, I saw something in the Express card slot of one of the machines that they had lent out to one of our interns. And I'm like, you know, you got something on the side of your Mac there. And he's like, oh, yeah. Because I didn't see a silver door. I saw something black.
Right.
And I went to the employee, coworker that gave it to him. And apparently it was like a little mini Unix or Linux embedded kind of device that apparently is self-contained and runs on a Express card slot.
Wow.
I'll have to get the name of it, but I was looking for the longest time and it really bothered me, but I had inadvertently gotten a machine at work that had Express card and the machine didn't have a parallel port. And apparently I had at the time the need to use a parallel port. I could never find, maybe they're out now, but I could never find Express card parallel port. PCMCIA, yes. There were parallel port adapters, but not for Express card. It seems there were people thinking of it. Maybe they eventually came out with it. Then again, it's probably time for a new computer.
Hey, now here's something, John, that I was just about to go into a rant about how, I was going to comment about how the Express card was probably one of the stupidest decisions that Apple has ever made to put in a computer. And you know what? I still agree with that. But for $119 bucks at Amazon, I just found a 32 gig. Which is not all that big, but 32 gig SSD drive that fits in your Express card slot.
Oh, a little baby one.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think this thing that he was talking about probably used one of those.
That's what made me think of it, and that's what I went to search for. Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Very cool.
Yeah.
An Express card is beefy enough that it'll zip right
along. It would cook. Yeah, exactly.
Well, as we spoke before, probably much better than your USB
Right. Exactly.
Or and on that, par with yep. SATA?
Yep. Well, that's what it is. Actually, it's a SATA, sort of thing, I guess. I don't know.
We're flinging those acronyms around like...
like it's nobody's business?
Business.
All right. Let's tell people how to get in touch with us if they have their own acronyms to fling there, John.
You know, the first thing, of course, you pick up the phone and you punch the buttons or you dial the dial if you know about that. And I would dial 206-666-GEEK, which is Dave.
4335. Reverse order, that's 5334. But you wouldn't dial it that way. You might write it that way if you were left-handed and you didn't want to smudge your words. So you might... So look, left-handed people, right? If they're writing on the paper, they have to learn not to rub their hand across all the letters they just wrote. I'm not a lefty. No, some of the doctors say I should have been, but Pete is. So I'm sure he could. I'm sure that's what all these Skype noises that we're hearing. He is a southpaw. There he is. Yeah. So so if you were a lefty, you would write 5334-6-666-602, but then you would actually dial it in the reverse order there.
Yeah, how else? So
feedback at MacGeekGab.com, which would be M-O-C dot B-A-G-K-E-E-G-C-A-M at K-C-A-B-D-E-E-F.
Yeah. Now, did you say feedback at MacGeekGab.com?
It would have been a whole lot easier if I had actually looked and just read that instead of trying to do it in my head.
Will you follow the script, man?
I'm trying. No, I'm not
trying.
All
right, you can Skype us.
He's left-handed, not dyslexic. Pete says in the Skype chat, thank you very much. You can Skype us.
Did he spell dyslexic? I think he spelled dyslexic.
He might have spelled that wrong. Yeah. No, actually, I don't think he did. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab. But don't forget about that email address, even if you have to write it down backwards to remember it, because that always makes it easier to remember things, you know, is feedback at MacGeekGab.com. All right.
Oh, and what else? You know, if you want to get a, you know, kind of find out what we're doing in our lives. Well, of course, we have Twitter.
Yeah,
we
do.
Twitter. You can Twitter us at MacGeekGab. Surprise. Right. Our individual, if you'd like to learn what's going on in our lives, not necessarily always having anything to do with the podcast. But I am John Efron. Dave Hamilton is Dave Hamilton. And Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete. And then, of course, there is the fountain of all knowledge and wisdom in the Mac world, the Mac Observer Twitter feed.
Right, at Mac Observer. All right.
They're simple.
We try to keep it simple, man. That's our whatever we do here. Sharon, let's move on to Sharon. So Sharon has an interesting issue here. We've crossed over from the short things into the longs. And, you know, I have to say, despite the fact that we weren't necessarily pithy and concise with our answers on the short things, they were definitely shorter than what you're about to get here. So Sharon writes, I have several clients in a local retirement community. They have a network supplied by the community that they all use to access the internet. When my clients who have Macs try to download something, it starts out fine, then gets slower and slower. The download speeds go lower and lower, and the download time goes higher and higher until the download eventually just stalls. If you restart it by clicking on the restart icon in the download window, it will start again and soon stop again. I was able to download Google Earth yesterday on a brand new iMac in about 40 minutes by just watching it and restarting it every time it stalled out. This happens with Safari and Firefox both. Everyone with a PC gets downloads just fine. No stalling, just a steady download. I called Apple once about this, and they said we needed to restart the router as though it were a home network. The woman at the retirement community, there are several hundred people on this network, actually tried restarting it for us, but it did not help. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and cite the answer that I emailed her, though I'm not...
You think? Okay.
Well, it's worth noting that several hundred people on one router can be an issue, and here's why. All routers have a maximum number of connections that they can service at any one point in time. My Linksys router, at least running the firmware that I have on it, can service 4,096 separate ports, is what it's called. Now,
really?
Yeah.
I think that should be sockets, but anyways, go ahead.
Well, they call it ports, but I would agree with you that it should be sockets. That's right. So the way it works is, when you go to load a web page, it might open, 10 different sockets, right? Because you're
a graphic, right? All the elements that make up a page. Yeah, that could be a big burst.
Yeah, that's right. So you multiply that by several hundred people. You know, if you've got 200 people that are all surfing the web, it doesn't take very long to count up to 4,000. Now, depending on how the router is set up, my guess is these routers work on first in, first out, right? So if you start your transfer and then 4,000 ports are needed after that by other people, well, you might just get lost in the shuffle. So that's a possibility. But it is worth noting, of course, that this only happens with the Mac clients and not with the Windows clients. Now, that could also be part of the same thing, but it's worth noting that. So
that's the weird part.
Yep.
Now, though, I had a question when I read this question, and I think you and I, or I think you, because I want to blame you for this.
Go ahead and blame me. It's fine. I can take it, man. I can take it.
Sharon did not explicitly state, I don't know why I'm stumbling here. I don't know why, but she did not mention whether this is wired or wireless or a mix of both. And I think you reviewed the question and confirmed
right.
that, Dave.
Right. Yeah. There's.
Knowing that, Sharon, if you could follow up with us, that'd be great, because my guess is that this is wireless.
Oh, that'd be a lot of wireless clients on one router.
Well, that's why I'm thinking
work.
Is that if it
work.
Is wired, or do you think it's a mix? What I'm saying is that I would think something like this would be more prone to problems if it was a wireless, all wireless environment than if it was wired.
My guess is it's wired. I mean, that's just a guess. I could be wrong. Yeah.
In either case, I would say problems with that number of people on a single device would crop up more quickly if you were in a wireless environment. Will you go with me on that, brother?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if it could be another with, maybe the people that are getting good performance, they got some, leases, DHCP leases, and they're, hooked up. And the other people are trying to get, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I think it sounds like she knows, based on Sharon's email, I would say she knows enough to have checked that. Though, it's always worth making sure, make sure the cable's plugged in, et cetera, right? I mean, but it sounds like she's,
I mean, I'm just trying to think of what is the correlation other than the platform? I mean, do all the Mac people hang out in one section?
are they segregated in the retirement community?
By choice, I would say. But no, are they in? I mean, it could be. So I don't know if there's one router or multiple, distribution points here. I'm thinking it may be a physical thing. There could be bad cabling, in which case these machines are just they're trying their best, but there's something wrong with the wiring or the they got cheap cables and stuff like that. If we're talking a wired environment, they'll get the correlation with it only happening with Macs again does kind of bother me, and I'm trying to explain my way out of why that shouldn't be the case. Don't pick on the Mac.
Don't. Yeah, I don't have the answer.
I've done throughput tests at work, and I've gotten, we got, standard, big boy Cisco routers, a couple of, and you've seen these monsters. I mean, we got our building probably has a couple of thousand people.
Yep.
And probably as many network connections. So we got two of these whopping Cisco things. I mean, you've seen these. I mean, there are hundreds of ports. Now, I don't know what class of device they're using in this place, if it's one of those or...
Yeah,
struggling. Maybe it's just underpowered. Can we take a stab at that?
Yeah.
But no, it only happens on the Macs.
That's right. Oh,
it's really bugging me, man. Come on, give me an answer, Dave.
I wish I had the answer. I don't have it.
I think we need more data.
We need more data. Yeah, but somebody out there might have seen something like that. So, if anybody has an idea, pass it along to us. We'll if it's relevant enough, we'll share it in the show. If it's too specific, we'll certainly pass it along to Sharon so that that her and her clients can live happy Mac-oriented lives. Puppies and rainbows. And
yes.
And now we're going to go into a really geeky question.
Hey, John and Dave. My name's Dave. Just calling in with a comment about the last episode, 208. You guys were talking at the end about the new 3GS and the new hardware and stuff. And one of you guys started making a comment about how you can't page in and out and the fixed RAM and all that stuff. I always thought the same thing, but something to bring to you guys' attention. Maybe you can figure out how this works. Program called iStat from the App Store. Very similar to like iStat and menu meters and stuff like that on the Mac. But iStat's supposed to give you all that same information on your iPod. And then it actually lets you like set up a server type client on the on your computers, and you can actually monitor them from the iPod program. But anyways, it sets up your iPod as the default. And so I'm looking at it. It shows me the wired, active, inactive, and free memory. And you can actually free up RAM when programs don't quit correctly. But to the right of that, it shows page ins and page outs. So I don't know if that's going to any free space on the hard drive, maybe, or like I have an 8-gig iPod Touch, and I know in iTunes it only shows it as 7.2 gigs usable or something. You never get that full 8 gigs, so maybe part of it is like a swap file, a swap page or something. So anyways, mine, for instance, shows page in 64,983 and page out 89. So anyways, it does seem like it has some swap file.
Okay, yeah. So it's worth remembering that the iPhone OS is Mac OS and underneath, which is Unix at the very core, right? So therefore, it is an operating system that supports the concept of virtual memory. And I believe from what I've seen, and this is just anecdotal stuff from apps like iStat and other reports, I believe what they've done on the iPhone is fixed the virtual memory size at 64 megabytes. Now, that may be 64 megs on the flash drive. I don't know if it's just 64 megs in RAM or what, but I believe it is fixed at that. It will not, your Mac's virtual memory size will continue to grow as necessary. And then it will shrink back down if you don't need it anymore. And virtual memory for the rest of you, the idea of virtual memory is as your computer needs more RAM than you have chips in there, it uses space on the hard drive to do this. So for the iPhone, and I'll get to your really in a minute, John, but just to finish this path here. So the iPhone is set with a fixed amount of virtual memory, which essentially means none, you know, or very little, enough to support what the OS expects to be able to do in terms of memory management, because it is just Unix at the core. And it is amazing that we have, you know, a Unix device sitting in our pockets that's way more powerful, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times, 600 times more powerful than the first computer I ever had. But yeah, it does have it, but not in the way that we're used to on the Mac, where it can just sort of expand out and do whatever it wants to do.
Well, so, doesn't it always boil down to, at least in most Unix-y type OSs, that there is a swap partition? In whatever file system you have.
In most Unix operating systems, but not in the Mac. There is no swap partition. What happens is the Mac, when it starts up, it creates a 64 meg swap file. And then as it needs to use more swap, it starts creating more. And as it creates each one, they double in size, right? So it creates a 64, then a 128, and then a 256, and you know, then it starts. I think the biggest ones are 1 gig in size, and they just keep, you know, going from there.
Okay, I've been doing some Unix installs lately, so
yep.
Just thought I'd bring that up. That it is a concept that, yeah, in one way or another is baked in there, either by a partition or a file, as you're saying. So it could go either way.
Now, the reason Apple did it as a file was because, you know, upgrading from OS 9 to OS 10, you know, we didn't have selective repartition or non-destructive repartitioning at the time. So you needed to be able to do something to use these swap files. So they started just creating files right there on your main drive. The problem is that's horribly inefficient. And we talked a little bit about that, you know, to tie this whole thing back together to the, you know, the run core SSD drives that we talked about at the beginning. part of the problem is if you've got a, if you, let's say you launch an app, right? And the app, this is the app that breaks the camel's back in terms of it needs, it requires your computer to need more RAM than you have. So now we've got a page out to swap. Now you've got one hard drive. You're reading the application and, you know, all its associated frameworks and data from your hard drive. And at the same time, the computer's saying, oh, I got to go page out. So now it's paging out to the same drive. That slows things down immensely. So a much more efficient thing would be to have your swap partition on a separate, completely separate drive, right? Mm-hmm. So one cool thing might be go ahead and get one of these, you know, 16 or 32 gig express card SSD drives, pop that in there. And then there are ways of telling OS X, go ahead and use something else, you know, use a separate drive for my swap. And now you're using, you know, a RAM drive for your swap. That could actually make things pretty efficient. And you can get a 16 gig, one of these things, I think, what do we find it for? $120. So that might actually be a cool little upgrade to do, John.
Remember when we were the cat's meow when we made RAM disks on our Apple IIs?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I think I remember that. Remember, I'll digress a little bit. But remember the bulletin board we ran?
Yeah.
And I believe what I did is I put my index file for my user database. I believe I put that as RAM disk.
You did. Yep.
Because I had improved it a little bit, but it was still dog slow because I had, you know, a lot of users.
Right.
So when I was looking up in an index file to find out, you know, to correlate the username to the user number, the record number in the database, I would rip through a file in the RAM disk because that was a case where I needed speed. I could not do that on a floppy or, well, it was sad if I tried.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was terrible. I mean, that was like the worst case scenario. So having a tiny little RAM disk really sped that up. You know, I haven't dabbled with that a lot lately on either the PC or the Mac.
We did on one of our servers, and I can't remember why we did this, but the answer to one of our issues with something to speed something up on one of the servers that we host the sites on was to create a very small RAM disk. I mean, it was maybe 128 megs or something to store, you know, some commonly used files. Or I forget what we did, but we're actually using it. And it did. It made a performance increase. It was Expression Engine, which is the software that we use to publish TMO, the content management system that we migrated to back in November. It stores all of... It goes and builds all of our pages and then stores them in a flat file cache because it's very quick to read from that. But even quicker is if that flat file cache is stored in a RAM drive. So so we do that. So there you go. That's it.
Okay. And where are we at?
Son of a gun. All right, let's try this again. We started getting that stuttery thing. Even though I'm saving the file out to the Drobo, you know, I knew when we started the show, remember I said to you, John, I should reboot the machine. I don't trust it. I think it's going to go stuttery tonight. Well, sure enough, I don't know if it's because we've actually got Pete is elsewhere in the world, and so we've got him on Skype. But I noticed
it's Pete's fault.
No, I don't think it is. At first I noticed that our CPU usage on the iMac here was much higher than normal. And that often means that there's something going on with the drive, but there's no virtual memory used and anything. So I thought, well, maybe it's just Skype because of Pete. Yep. But I don't think it is. He's in Shanghai. So
I got one thing to say.
What do you have to say?
206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. Email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And Dave, did you say feedback@macgeekgab.com?
I said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I thought that's what you said.
iPhoneAlley.com is where Michael Johnston spends his time when he's not either converting this show or driving around the country. Last week's AAC conversion, Michael emailed me that night and said, oh, dude, I'm driving around the country, you know, road trip. And so I can't do it. So I actually did the conversion last week and it went swimmingly well up until the end when I realized that GarageBand was flaking out on me and creating files without links in them, even though it said it would. But so I had to sort of rebuild it. But anyway, that was me. But Michael says he's back and rip raring to go. So this one
rip
will
raring?
Rip raring, man.
Rip roaring.
Yeah. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth from to get the data from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF pen from Smile on My Back and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And one thing we really like, and there are lots of them out there now, I think we got another, I don't know, it looks like we got another 20 or 30 iTunes comments in the last week, John, and then we always like that. So
nice. So yeah. we're still trouncing Christensen there?
I don't know. I got to check
Adam,
that out. Yeah.
Adam.
With
I'm
the
looking
Maccast
at you,
there.
Adam.
That's right.
He's our pal. He rocks.
And you know, there was a rant last week about Little Snitch, and John Martellaro wrote a rebuttal to my rant about Little Snitch. And my retort is coming. So, you know, Mr. Martellaro, be careful you don't get caught.
Maynard.